This is Near FM
90.3. My next guest is from Social Justice Ireland, and they have just published their yearly report on poverty. Poverty Focus 2021 just came out there on 26th of April. And to talk to us and discuss the findings of this recent report is Michelle Murphy from Social Justice Ireland. Hello, Michelle. How are you?
Hello. Good morning, Adrienne.
So, tell us about this. What are the latest data and trends on poverty in Ireland?
Well, the latest data now relates to 2019. There's a time lag with these figures, and it's collected by the Central Statistics Office. So it's what the most recent findings tell us, that one in every eight people in Ireland lives with an income below the poverty line. So that's about 630,000 people. 15% of all of those who are living in poverty have a job, and a quarter of all of those living in poverty are children. I suppose those would be concerning trends, in particular the people who have a job, who are employed, the working poor. I mean, that figure has stayed pretty much static for more than a decade. You know, that group, so they haven't made the right changes in order to reach that group to lift them out of poverty. And in terms of children as well, it's about 190,000 children. And you know, we've never really gotten to grips with the child poverty challenge either. And it's typically around 200,000 plus children annually. And I suppose our concern really would be is that these figures relate to 2019, when we're going to see the figures for 2020 and 21, and you see the impact of the pandemic and the job losses and all those other things factored in. I think you're going to see a significant rise in, I suppose, the poverty figures and the deprivation figures as well.
Yes, most definitely. It's going to have a terrible effect, all right. Now, you're saying that this year, but you're saying it was 2019, because in the report that you sent through, it said this year we pay particular attention to the impact of social welfare rates on low-income households. So tell us about that.
So what we did was I suppose the rate of poverty has fallen slightly over the past number of years. It's welcome. And what we did is then we went and looked back at the budgets, we'd say from 2017, and looked at the impact of social welfare increases in those budgets on poverty. And what you found is from budget 2017, 2018 and 2019, everybody saw an increase, but proportionately the increase for, I suppose, welfare-dependent or very vulnerable houses was larger than other households. Like, it wasn't a huge amount, but proportionately it was larger. And what you saw as a result of that then, when it actually, you know, when you were getting the statistics coming through, granted there is a delay, but you did see the corresponding fall in poverty for those groups. So what's really concerning for us, though, in the past two budgets, there has been no increase in the core social welfare rate, the base rate of €203.
Yes.
So what you're going to see is that the progress that was being made is going to stall or reverse. Then you're also going to see, you know, within those groups, we mentioned children, there's also people with a disability. Although it's only a small group, they have a very high risk of poverty rate of 37.5%. I mean, that's incredibly high. And even though our pensioners, older people, it's about 62,000 pensioners, so 10.5% of that cohort over 65, that's still a lot of old people who, you know, are living on a very, very low income. And although that number has remained, I suppose, relatively stable, for want of a better term, it's still concerning that so many, given that people are living longer, that so many people over the age of 65 are now, they're just reliant on state supports, and it's just about keeping them over the poverty line. So, you know, there's a lot of concerning trends, but the one thing that, you know, our research does show, that if you do, if government increases social welfare, particularly targeting households on the lowest income, so the core social welfare rate, you do see a reduction in poverty. So I suppose now, you know, the talk now is about how to move people from the COVID supports of the pandemic unemployment payment, you know, how they're going to move them onto the basic social welfare rate in advance of the budget. And what we're saying in advance of the budget is you need to be looking at the core social welfare rates, and you need to increase that, because if you don't take action in this budget, you know, next year you're going to have all those people who were on the pandemic unemployment payments, which now, you know, it looks like they're going to be, if they don't go back into employment, they'll be moving to a rate which is much lower than what they're already on. And, you know, it's a challenging to survive on such a low income, and the impact that that will have on those people. So, I mean, that's why we focused on the impact of social welfare this year, because I think that that can get lost in the discussion sometimes.
Oh, most definitely. But not only that, like the effects of pandemic, we have seen ourselves, everybody's seeing and talking about it, that have you seen the price of the groceries? You know, everything's getting so much more expensive because I suppose they can't get the stuff in. And, you know, so things are increasing drastically and they're not bringing anything up in line with it. As you say, they haven't raised that in quite some time, the welfare payments. So you've made some recommendations, the Social Justice Ireland have made some recommendations within this report, but not only for that, to try to raise that, also with regards to pensions and with regards to taxation and other things. Do you want to talk to us about that?
Yes. So I suppose we make a number of recommendations in the report itself. So obviously one of the key ones that you mentioned there is that we social welfare rates we're proposing should be benchmarked to average earnings, and you'd probably start that at, you know, the minimum rate that should be 222 euros a week. Beyond that, then, if you look at people disability, for example, you know, there is a real case to be made now for a cost of disability allowance for people with disability, because the poverty rate for that group is so high. They've a very low labour market participation rate, and, you know, they face an ongoing daily cost as a result of their disability. Then in terms of pensioners and older people, we would be looking at, you know, you need to look at a universal state pension. There is the Commission on Pensions that have just been set up, but or it's recently been established, but it's not even looking at the impact of things such as auto-enrolment. And there is a cohort of pensioners out there, and they're predominantly women, you know, who aren't entitled to anything as a result of previous, I suppose, legislation issues around pension, marriage, etc. And, you know, they're living in very challenging circumstances, and it's like it's almost as if their voices are ignored. Then in terms of people who have a job, I mean, there's a very simple thing you can do for that group of people, and it's to make your tax credits, the two main tax credits, refundable. Now, it would only apply to that cohort of people, because the rest of us, we get the full value of our tax credit, but they don't earn enough money to get the full value of the tax credit. You know, so there's about 100,000 workers, but then when you take their families into account, I mean, that is, you know, it's a simple thing you can do. Revenue can do it on a weekly basis at this stage. And the amount of money to the person isn't necessarily significant, but it brings them above the poverty line. And in terms of the cost, it's about between 110 and 130 million euros, which is not huge in the greater scheme of things, but the impact on those people is significant because you are lifting them out of poverty. And then in terms of children, obviously, you know, you have to look at the household, because children don't live in isolation. So obviously child benefit is a key issue, but also the access to services that those children have. Their parents, you know, do they have access to, you know, decent wages for their employment? And do they have access to the, you know, the supports required? So these are all the different recommendations that we've made. And we have sent it to everyone in government and all the TDs and senators. And we're hoping to present it now to an Oireachtas committee. Because I suppose our fear is it's that these people were already incredibly vulnerable before COVID hit, and they've almost been forgotten now. And now as the focus moves to, you know, tapering away the COVID income supports, etc., you know, the focus is rightly going to be on the people who are reliant on them. But this group of people that were already in difficulty are, you know, if we don't do something for them now, they're simply going to be left further behind. You know, and we're talking already about recovery and growth in certain parts of the economy, but there's other parts of the economy and society that, you know, probably won't see a recovery until at least 2023 and are in very difficult positions, but their voices, you know, just simply don't register in these discussions. So what we're trying to do here is get a focus on, you know, the lived reality for these people, and what are the what are the policies the government can implement to actually make a difference to their lives.
And now, what about housing with regards to high rents that are putting people out of their homes? Have you made any suggestions to the government with
yes,
that?
Yes, in terms of housing, I suppose our core suggestion is that they 20% of the whole house of the our entire housing stock ultimately should be social housing, because we have a huge problem with housing affordability, supply of social housing in this country. And the minister is he's launching his affordable housing bill today, which in reality isn't going to make housing any more affordable for people. In fact, it will probably do the opposite, because it's just going to artificially keep prices where they are and where they were. So in terms of housing, first you need to look at increasing your supply, particularly of social housing and affordable housing. So that means looking at a cost rental model as well, moving away from things like shared equity, which, at the end of the day, shared equity is just going to keep prices artificially high, and it's not going to help those people who are in housing need. And if you did increase the supply of social housing, and there's plenty of state land to do that, and implement a cost rental model, then what you do is you'd also take the pressure off the private rented sector. So that, rents would fall in the private rent, and you would have more affordable housing available to people, be that those who want to own their own home or those who are in the rental market. Because at the moment, and, I'm sure most of your listeners probably read that story recently about the private equity firms are keeping their rents incredibly high in apartments across Dublin City. But, they give their tenants discounts, but they do it in a way so that, when it comes to rent reviews, the rent that they state was the rent remains. So they're keeping prices artificially high. And that's a loophole for them to avoid legislation that was brought in to prevent that. And, at the end of the day, it's not providing affordable housing for anybody. And, the impact of housing is huge, because it puts pressure on wages and various other things. Whereas if government could address the cost of housing and actually provide affordable homes and social housing for people, I think the country would be in a far better position. But, I think what's been announced today won't deliver that and won't do that. And that's what's really concerning for us, is that the policy is still ultimately focused on private supply, and we still haven't, government still haven't come out and said, the state is going to build the amount of homes that we need to eliminate the social housing waiting list, for example, and we are going to do it over, a 5, 6, 7 year period, and this is where we're going to, that is what they need to do, but that is not what is coming from government at the moment.
Yeah, they don't seem to have a plan of action in that regards at all. And to me, it's always the fat cats are getting fatter, the developers and landlords are able to call the shots. And, even if they brought in some sort of a capping system or rates for rent, because they seem to be able to charge what they like, and because there's so many people out there, it's just awful. But what about the fact that 1 in 10 children in Ireland leave school with literacy problems? So what about the thing with education and poverty? That link?
Yes, there is a significant link there. And the CSO published just in December last year a study looking at the impact of, intergenerational transmission of poverty and the link between poverty and education. And so it looked at teenagers who were living in, households, they were living at risk of poverty, so in households with low incomes. So they looked at them when they were teenagers, and then a decade later. And what they found is, if you're living in poverty, your educational outcomes are poorer. So you're less likely to go to college. You're less likely to have a job. You're more likely to be unemployed, or you're more likely to be in precarious employment. You're more likely to be in poor accommodation. You're more likely to be in poor health. You're more likely to leave school early. That's incredibly concerning, especially now when you look at the impact of school closures, particularly on, you know, the students from disadvantaged areas, because school closures have had an impact on everybody. But at the same time, they are going to have a more detrimental impact on those students who are already disadvantaged in the first place, because they didn't necessarily have the, you know, the technological means to engage in online learning. And plus, you need the support. You need the support from other members of your household. And, you know, learning is dynamic. Ultimately, you need to be in the classroom. So, and really, I suppose progress has stalled. You know, there is a DET program and there's targets for literacy and numeracy, you know, in terms of second level and primary education, and, you know, disadvantaged students, and they're better off peers. But I suppose progress has really stalled since 2012, and that's concerning. So, and what really makes the difference there is a lower pupil teacher ratio, lower classes, and, you know, ensuring those schools have the resources that require. We're not seeing the outcomes that we should be seeing there. And, you know, globally, the OECD did a study just looking at the impact of COVID. And in terms of the impact on your lifetime earnings of, you know, someone who's been in secondary school and impacted by the school closures last year and this year, they're looking at earning throughout their lifetime 3% less than we'd say their peers last in 2019 who weren't impacted by school closures. I mean, that's a significant number. It's a staggering statistic. But then for students from disadvantaged backgrounds, it's going to be even more. And even those students who do make it from a disadvantaged background, who actually do make it to third level, when they graduate, they earn, you know, on average about €600 less per annum, between 2,000 and €600 less per annum than someone who's graduated from the same course but who's from a more affluent background. So even for those who make it through the system into higher education and who graduate with a degree, there's still an earnings penalty for them as a result of, you know, growing up in a situation of disadvantage. So, you know, you rightly point out that's a worrying trend here, and I suppose it doesn't necessarily get the attention it really should.
Definitely not, you know, because education has been shown to be a way out of poverty. You know, but as you say, then if they're being penalised for where they're from or whatever, you know, it is worrying.
And it is, education is key and income is key. But even if you look at how, I suppose, the past, you know, 18 months have shown us how unprepared the education system, I won't say the system, but we'd say the Department of Education was in terms of the Leaving Certificate. And, you know, our Leaving Certificate certainly needs reform anyway, but we haven't even started on that reform. And as ill-prepared as we were in 2020 for how we were going to manage the Leaving Cert, I mean, the fact that they were ill-prepared again in 2021, that to me is astonishing, because it shows a lack of thinking, a lack of, you know, preparation within that department. Because we have to look at, when you look at those children now who are going through second level, and it's two cohorts now who won't have sat a junior cert. So they don't even have the experience of sitting a state examination and all that entails. And yet they've been impacted by school closures and all the loss of learning as a result of that. So, you know, it's unclear how is the department going to ensure that we make up for that loss of learning? You know, what is the important learning you need to make up for? You know, what do they see as that can be made up, or what other areas can just the students make up for themselves? And then how do you prepare them for a state exam if they've no experience of one? And how are we going to, I suppose, develop or reform our system so that the Leaving Certificate at the end of the day is not the be-all and end-all, and that there are other routes into further and higher education for our young people?
Yes, I don't know. As you say, it seemed crazy that they weren't more prepared the second time round. You know, it wasn't as if they didn't see it coming first time, but definitely we knew this was going to happen, you know, again.
And you would have thought there would be a backup plan at least.
Yes.
That if it couldn't go ahead in 2021, then this is the, you know, this is the process. So it would have taken away any uncertainty for students and for teachers and for parents. But, you know, that didn't happen, and that's concerning. So that would also make me concerned then as to what sort of planning is going on about how they're going to reform the fifth and sixth year cycle, how we look at, you know, broadening out access routes to education, because a written exam and rote learning doesn't actually suit everybody. And how do you support those, for example, who want to go into apprenticeships and then move into further higher education, or people with different skill sets? So it's not all focused on one exam in June every year and the stress, you know, that goes along with that as well for students and teachers and their families. But, you know, that I think that will probably come, I suppose, more of a, I think once the leaving certificate this year has been completed and, you know, the twin track process, whether it's predictive grade or you do your exam, I think then in September we probably will see more discussions as well, what's the most appropriate way to run.
But for years, yeah, for years before COVID or any of this, for years people have been saying they needed to do, you know, ongoing assessment and not have it all based on the one exam. So this is going back now almost 10 years, I'd say, if not more, that it was, you know, they were supposed to be bringing on board this, that they were going to assess people as they went along. And as you rightly said, exams don't suit everybody. And it is like just a memory test. You go in, if you've a good memory, you can cram a load in and go in. And whereas somebody else may not, and they may just fall apart at an exam, they've been brilliant all the way along, you know, so they really need to get down and get this sorted. But I don't know, with every single area, as you said, with housing and with the education, everything, it's kind of kicked the can along the road and just kick it down, keep passing it on till the next guys come in and take over and let them kick it along for a bit. And nothing seems to be changing. It's taking so long for them to change anything.
It is, but I suppose the one thing now I think they might be for is people have seen that you actually can change. That's the one thing the pandemic has shown, that the system, if it needs to, can actually act at speed. So if people remember back to the general election campaign in January and February of last year, you know, things like a moratorium on evictions, a cap on rent increases, you know, I suppose a moratorium on repossession absolutely could not be countenanced or considered. More money for the health service was absolutely a no-no. Yet overnight, we managed to introduce an online social welfare system, well, set at €350 a week, significantly higher than the core payment. And the department did a great job of processing payments online and ensuring that people weren't, you know, left hanging in terms of their payments. And yes, like some mistakes were made, but it was showed how quickly that could be done. Same things in terms of the amount of money that suddenly went into our health system, where a month before absolutely could not be done. But it was done and it needs to be done. And I really do hope now that, you know, as we emerge from this, we look at the money that we do need to put into community care, primary care, home care, home health, keeping people out of acute hospitals and caring for them in their communities, the places where they live. The same with housing. We could suddenly introduce a moratorium on evictions and various other things when it had to be done. So it shows that the system can change, and it can change quickly, and it can actually do some very good things. That requires, I suppose, it requires leadership and political will. And I think now that people have seen that you actually can change, I don't think they'll accept the, you know, I suppose, a response from an elected representative anymore that they can't change because of bureaucracy or X, Y, or Z, because things actually can change. We, you know, government departments can implement new policy. Mm. They can do it at speed. The question is whether politically that is what government wants to do.
If they have the will to do it.
Yes, and as you say, it's been over, in terms of education, you know, people have been calling for reform for the Leaving Cert for well over a decade. And I think now that will become, along with housing and health, that is going to become an area of focus now after the Leaving Certificate this year. I think people will really start to push for change and think about, you know, how we make the system better. As you say, it doesn't assess, you know, it doesn't assess people's skills properly. It doesn't assess their problem-solving skills, their creativity, their adaptability. It simply assesses them on a set of questions on a particular time frame on a particular day in June. You know, it doesn't assess all the work that they've done throughout their time in education, and it does certainly need reform. And I think we have seen that change is possible. So I really hope that people don't accept that they're happy enough to just go back to the way things were, because the way things were not great for a lot of people. So we should be looking at how we can make things better for people.
Definitely. Oh, most definitely. Now, people can download free copies, digital copies of this report from socialjustice.ie, can they?
They can, yes. Yeah. It's on socialjustice.ie, and we're also, free copies of the report are there. And for any of your listeners who are interested in basic income, we're hosting a webinar next Wednesday at lunchtime, 1 o'clock, looking at basic income and how you might implement the commitment to government for a basic income pilot. It's free, but because it's on Zoom, you just need to register so you get the link, and that's also there if anybody's interested in that.
And what will that be entailing? What would
So I suppose the Programme for Government committed to a basic income pilot, and then last year the Arts and Culture Recovery Task Force recommended a basic income for artists. So the webinar, we're going to look at how you might implement the basic income for artists as the pilot, and then we're going to have responses, you know, show how it might be done, and we're going to have responses from the trade union sectors and from representatives from arts and culture as well, and then just a discussion about the proposal itself.
Very good. That would be fantastic, because the arts were really left high and dry through the pandemic, you know, and they really were hit so hard. So that would be a very, very good thing, yeah.
Yes, they really were. And even when you look at the reopening plans, or the plans that we've seen so far, I mean, it's the culture and recreational, so that's the art sector, you know, was kind of at the bottom of the queue for a lot of things, and they've really struggled. An industry where income is precarious at the best of times, you know, they've really, really struggled in the past, you know, 14 or 15 months. And, you know, that sector will probably be one of the slowest to come back. So it does, you know, they do need ongoing support. So this webinar is going to look at, you know, how, if government were of a mind, you know, here is how you could do your basic income pilot for artists. So you're not only implementing the pilot that you committed to in the Programme for Government, but you're also implementing one of the recommendations of, the main recommendation actually of the Arts and Culture Recovery Task Force.
Fantastic. I can't wait now myself, and I'm sure everybody's in the same boat, dying for the events and things to come back, you know, because it's very good for our mental health. You know, any of these things, going to the theatre, going to a show, a live gig, it's so good for us, you know, to get out, and arts and culture, it's just, we need it. And I really feel that the government had kind of lost it there at one stage, you know, when one of the ministers was saying that, you know, why don't they just go and retrain somebody who's been 50, 60 years as a musician, and, you know, retrain now for something else. It just seemed a very bad way of...
And not even valuing the training
exactly
that goes into
yes.
being an artist or a
yes.
performer, and the years, the hours and days and weeks and months of years of training and skill that goes into that. And I you know, it's great for people's mental health, it's great for culture, but it's also great for expanding people's horizons and making people think. You know, I think that's the great thing about art and culture. It's a space to, you know, question things and allow people to think and to question, you know, what's going on around them. And I think we really need it, and it's sorely, sorely missed. So, you know, I'm hoping that, you know, we get a lot of elected representatives coming to the webinar.
Yes. And that webinar, they can register through socialjustice.ie.
Yeah, they just go onto the website socialjustice.ie and it's free. It's just register so you get the Zoom link, you know, to your phone or to your computer so you can log in.
Thank you so much, Michelle, for coming on. It's been such an interesting conversation and I'm sure we'll be talking to you again soon.
Thank you very much.
Not at all.
Pleasure.
Take care. God bless, Michelle. Bye-bye.
This is Near FM
90.3.